We'll hear argument in the first matter on calendar, which is the Zambada. Mr. Crawford.
Primarily the issue in this case is whether or not the district court was proper in imposing the two-level upward departure under 2D1.1, or use for possession of a firearm during commission of the offense. We believe that the court looks at the chronology, looks at the dates, and everything alleged to have occurred that met the standard of showing that it's clearly improbable that the firearm is connected to the offense. In particular, the indictment itself, in count one of the conspiracy, alleged that Mr. Zambada participated in two overt acts. The first overt act occurring on April 5th, 2000. The second overt act occurring on June 26th, 2000.
Does the possession have to be at the time of the overt acts, or is it sufficient that the possession occurs at any time during the conspiracy?
But if the court also looks at the indictment alleges that the conspiracy ended in or about October 2000. The search of the residence occurred on November 2nd, 2000, after the conspiracy in count one is alleged to have come to an end. Now, when they found the gun was in a closet. The wife said, "That's my husband's gun." She did connect the appellant to the gun, even if it was registered to another person in Redlands or something like that. And I understand the presence of the gun in the master bedroom, together with the wife's connection, could arguably make some connection to the gun. But mere ownership of a firearm in and of itself should not be enough to warrant imposition of the enhancement. What if the defendant had a gun and it was in storage and he hadn't even seen it in 5 years? And during the commission of the conspiracy, the police searched the storage shed and find the gun. Where's the connection?
But if he had used the storage shed to make some telephone calls with respect to transacting the drug business and had people deliver cash to the storage shed, possibly it gets a little tougher?
It gets more difficult, and the line where to draw the line is precisely, I believe, why we're here today, because we don't. It's not a case where an officer pulls over a defendant or a suspect. They find the gun in the underneath. Those cases, we wouldn't even be here today arguing this. The other cases cited by the government was Lopez-Sandoval. In Lopez-Sandoval, it was undisputed that the gun was discovered during the commission of the conspiracy.
Refresh us, counsel, as to exactly what the standard of proof is.
I believe they have to show the burden on the government in establishing?
The burden on the government and the burden on your client.
Okay, well, I believe the government, in order to justify imposition of the upward departure, has to show by preponderance of the evidence under 2D1.1 that the firearm is connected to the offense. And then the burden, I don't know what, when you say on my client, I don't believe he should have a burden at this point. Unless maybe if there's a firearm, then the question would be whether or not it's clearly improbable that the firearm is connected with the offense.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe still, since the government is the one that's the beneficiary of the upward departure, they are the ones that should be maintaining the burden from the outset. But based upon the way that the gun was connected to the outside of the conspiracy, after the conspiracy had come to an end, I don't believe it would be appropriate for the court to oppose that upward departure. The other thing I think the court needs to determine is with regard to the safety valve. Under 5C 1.1, the courts have been uncertain as to whether or not a per se rule would apply because of the fact that there's a firearm present under 5C, the safety valve is inappropriate. But when the district court in this particular case ruled that the safety valve was inapplicable and didn't apply the rest of the standards, he said, well, 2D1.1 applies, so therefore he's not entitled to safety valve relief as well. But I believe that, in effect, is a per se rule of ineligibility. And
that's not exactly what the district court said.
But I think it seemed to be, by finding 2D1.1 applicable, it was finding per se ineligibility for the safety valve. And I don't know if the courts have actually clarified in its decisions whether
What the district court actually found was that the record supports the enhancement and the record eliminates the safety valve. Now, the district court, in this case, unlike Nelson, did not say the enhancement applies, therefore the safety valve is not available. And there's a pretty big difference.
I still think the courts need some type of guidance as to what, if this enhancement is applicable, should the safety valve be necessarily inapplicable, or should there be some type of litany test that the court should apply in determining whether or not the defendant is safety valve eligible? Based on that, unless the court has any questions.
Okay. Mr. Silver.
May it please the Court, Eric Silver on behalf of Appellee of the United States. To answer Judge Fletcher's question, the burden of proof in this case under 2D1.1b1 was first on the government to establish by a preponderance of the evidence possession. Then the burden shifted to defendant to establish that it was clearly improbable that the firearm was connected to the offense. So actually the burden in this case was on defendant to establish the connection issue.
Is that the same for the enhancement and for the safety valve?
It is not the same for the safety valve. As this Court indicated in Nelson, under the safety valve, the defendant bears the burden of proof that there was not a connection between the firearm and the drug offense, but it's only by a preponderance of the evidence. The burden of proof in both instances, under 2D1.1 and under the safety valve, are on the defendant. It's simply a matter of the amount of the burden of proof is on the defendant. As Judge Reimer noted, the district court's findings, the ultimate findings that are at ER 113, do indicate that the court at least suggested that the court looked at the record in making a safety valve interpretation. Nevertheless, the government will note that at ER 103, the court stated the principal focus is the gun enhancement, not only because it adds 2 points, but because it precludes the departure below the safety valve. I actually think that that statement by the district court suggests that it was confused about whether the imposition of the gun enhancement precluded the safety valve. Don't, however, think that that requires reversal in this instance. Under 18 U.S.C. Section 3742, reversal is only required for an incorrect application of the guidelines if the sentence resulted from that incorrect application. And there's really 2 related reasons why, even if the court was confused about the burden of proof issue, that it did not, in fact, result in the incorrect application here. First is, unlike this court's decision in Nelson, the district court did not expressly make its findings using the clearly improbable standard. There, in Nelson, the court, in making the safety valve determination, expressly found that it was not clearly improbable under the safety valve that the gun was connected with the offense. Here, the court didn't make that type of finding. What it made was affirmative findings of fact. Again, it was defendant's burden of proof in any event to establish that there was no connection, but the court's findings here was the defendant possessed the gun, that it was in his residence, that it was loaded, that it was the type of gun that would be used in a drug trafficking offense. There was drug trafficking equipment, a scale, and it also noted the amount of the drugs, which is a drug trafficking amount. Those are affirmative findings establishing a connection between the drug trafficking and the firearm. And that also it relates to really the second reason why under 3742F1 no reversal would be required in this case, even if there was confusion. And that really goes to harmless error. In United States v. Coluna, this court indicated the harmless error standard does apply to burden of proof issues. And here the error really, to the extent there was one, was harmless. Ordinarily, mere proximity between a firearm and drugs is sufficient to establish a connection between the two. This court indicated that in Gillock and even noted that that was sufficient under 924C to support a conviction, although obviously that was before the Supreme Court's decision in Bailey.
You agree that the conspiracy ended about a month before the search?
Well, the indictment actually does say that it ended in or about October. Nevertheless, the in or about language would merely require the act to have been on a date reasonably near the date alleged in the indictment. I do think November 2nd is a date reasonably near October 2000. And this court in Hinton, for example, has noted that an 18-day gap is sufficient to place something within the date alleged in the indictment. I do think that the 2-day gap from October here would be sufficient. At the end result, it doesn't really matter under this court's decision in Willard, because as this court noted in Willard, relevant conduct can be used under 2D1.1 And so even if the conspiracy had ended, there still was a drug trafficking offense that was taking place on November 2nd, and that was the possession of the 193.6 grams of cocaine. And that was a drug trafficking amount. Again, as the court indicated, there was a scale found with it. There was a firearm that's associated with drug trafficking, namely a semi-automatic pistol. And so even if the court were to conclude that it was outside the date of the conspiracy, it still is relevant conduct. Now, of course, to the extent it's inside the scope of the conspiracy, this court has indicated that that is sufficient, that possessing it during the scope of the conspiracy is sufficient. But relevant conduct would also establish it. So here I think that the court did indicate that, did make findings establishing a connection. I think this is more than a mere proximity case, which itself would be sufficient based on the nature of the gun and the drug trafficking equipment. Also note the defendant's statement regarding possession. As defendant notes, defendant's wife indicated that he purchased the firearm and he owned it. Now, defendant indicates that, well, mere ownership wouldn't be sufficient. And this court has held that that ownership is not itself sufficient to establish constructive possession. But it really, all else you need is access, and that was what happened here. An example of where ownership alone is not sufficient is this court's decision in Casterline. There, the defendant was in jail at the time he was alleged to have possessed the gun, and the guns were in a storage locker of the sheriff's department. And the court in that case, and that was a felon in possession case, indicated, well, he couldn't possess the guns, even constructively possess the guns, even though he owned them, because he had no access to them, given his circumstances and given the gun's location in the sheriff's evidence locker. It's nothing like the case here. The defendant was home at the time the firearm was present. He had access to it. It was a loaded firearm at the time. And that's really all that's sufficient. This court has indicated in Barron Rivera that ownership, when you combine it with some form of access, is sufficient to establish constructive possession, as has this court in Fuchon. So I think the combination of the ownership and the connection between the firearm and the drug trafficking is sufficient to establish both the 2D1.1B1 enhancement and the safety valve. If the court has no further questions, I'll submit.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Crawford?
When the court, when counsel was discussing the other relevant conduct under 1B1.3, I think one of the things that the court needs to look at is application note 3 to 2D1.1. In application note 3 to the gun enhancement, the Sentencing Commission basically indicated that the reason for this upward enhancement is the increased dangerousness that exists when a gun is in the defendant's possession during commission of a drug offense, based on the heightened, either because of the effects of the drugs on the subject himself or because of the increased hostility that exists between the buyer and the seller during the course of the transaction. But if the court looks at the purpose under the application note 3, then the court should determine how far 1B1.3 should be applied for purposes of the court's, what is relevant conduct, I guess is what I'm asking. If the conspiracy apparently ended in October of 2000, now why didn't the indictment allege it ended until November 2000? Apparently the government didn't have enough proof to show that the conspiracy extended that far.
Counsel, what is your position regarding the in or about phrasing of the indictment? The government argues that in or about October gets you as far as November 2nd. Do you agree or disagree?
I would disagree with that. I don't have the cases at hand, but I believe that the indictment alleges that, and the indictment, which is the facts to which the appellant admitted the truth of when he entered a plea of guilty, he basically admitted that up until in or about October 2000, the conspiracy was in place.
And so why isn't it reasonable to suppose find from the facts alleged that the gun had been present 2 days earlier that would have brought it in October?
I believe that there should have been some type of proof because the government initially has the burden of showing that there was a firearm in the defendant's possession in connection with the offense. And in this particular case, I don't believe that was established because it was not established that the firearm was in that closet. The wife didn't say, oh, my husband bought it a week ago, or he bought it 2 weeks ago, or he bought it a month ago, or he's had it sitting in the closet for 5 years. There's no indication when the gun was purchased, under what circumstances it was purchased, and when or how long it had been in that closet. And I believe some type of threshold showing should have been made by the government in order to have justified the upward departure. And as again, as to the relevant conduct, is the conduct relevant if it's outside of the scope of the conspiracy, outside of what the defendant admitted to when he pleaded guilty and admitted the truth of the facts in the indictment? What relevancy does it have? It was outside of the scope of the plea and the allegations in the indictment.
Well, we can consider conduct which is outside the indictment or outside the plea. Is that not correct?
Yes, ma'am, but would that mean that every subject that has a firearm, that has ever owned a firearm, should be subject to the enhancement? Where to draw the line, I guess, is where the question is.
Well, where the government, I guess, would draw it is that there were drugs in his possession, which was in itself a crime on the day of the search.
Yes, I believe it was approximately 193 grams of cocaine was found in addition to the firearm. But the conspiracy to which the defendant had pleaded guilty to apparently ended in October 2000. It doesn't indicate when in October. And counsel indicates, well, a two-day difference. It could have been early October. Then it would have been a 30-day difference. And I believe that the indictment was ambiguous as to when the conspiracy actually ended. And based upon that, I believe the defendant should be entitled to the benefit of the doubt. The district court erred in imposing the enhancement. We'd ask that the court send it back.
Okay, thank you both for your argument in the matter just argued will be submitted. Well, next your argument in Johnson versus Garcia.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Tracy Dressner for Petitioner Dwayne Johnson. There are two issues in this case. One was whether Mr. Johnson's confession was involuntary, and the second whether, if it was indeed involuntary and admitted erroneously, whether that error was harmless.
Counsel, isn't the real question whether the state appellate court was unreasonable in concluding what it did?
Yes.
And for me alone, I'm not speaking for the panel, but the issue that I'd like you to address is the question of whether the state court's analysis of harmlessness was unreasonable in view of the eyewitness, the victim, and the fact that the jury did not convict of some of the crimes to which he had confessed.
Yes. The state applied the wrong harmless error test. What the state did was say, if we took the confession away, was there enough evidence to convict Mr. Johnson? And they concluded that there was, based on the eyewitness testimony.
Well, the State Court of Appeals applied a Chapman analysis, which I assume to be correct, on direct review.
Well, they cited Chapman, but in fact, they applied a whether without that confession there was enough evidence to convict, and that's not the appropriate test.
I thought they said it was inconceivable that the result could be any different without the confession. And without playing word games with the state court, why isn't that a reasonable application of Chapman to these facts?
Well, particularly in this case, what's key to remember is the robbery in this case was a very small part of the case against Mr. Johnson. He was facing, this was a death penalty trial where there was a murder allegation and two other robbery allegations. And the only thing that the jury convicted Mr. Johnson was of the robbery that were in this case that's at issue. The bulk of the evidence in the murder case came from the same confession that should have been suppressed, because it was coerced. And what's key is that the jury hung on the murder count, which meant that at least some of the jurors believed that Mr. Johnson had committed a murder. And, in fact, that murder charge was retried two more times.
Why doesn't they just cut the other way? I mean, it shows that the jury was able to compartmentalize the confession and that it wasn't influenced by it.
Well, what we don't know is whether the jury hung over which count, which degree of murder, first and second, which I think is the reasonable reading of the record, or whether they hung on guilt or innocence. But regardless, those jurors who believed that Mr. Johnson was guilty of murder had to have relied on his confession, because that was 95% of the evidence against Mr. Johnson in the murder case. With respect to the other robbery, which the state court also relies on, that's sort of a red herring, because the court dismissed the other robbery count at the end of the prosecution's case, so the jury never never had to decide whether whether Mr. Johnson was guilty of the second robbery.
Well, counsel, my difficulty is that what you construct is a possible alternative analysis of harmless error that's also reasonable. But we would have to find, in order to hold for your client, that the state court's analysis, which relied heavily on the fact that there was the victim positively identified him as the robber, that that's unreasonable. And I guess I just don't see how that is an unreasonable analysis under harmless error standard, the highest possible harmless error standard.
Well, first, it's whether the confession, it's not whether the jury, if this case had been tried strictly as a robbery case and no confession, would they have convicted him? That's not the test. The test is, did the admission of the confession have any kind of substantial and injurious effect on the jury? And we're talking not one, the state court failed to discuss the inconsistencies in the eyewitness testimony, the fact that they had the wrong height, the wrong weight. There was no discussion of the fact that the same that the pizza delivery man had delivered pizza to petitioner's home on a number of occasions and was a pizza delivery man in the general area where Mr. Johnson lived. It's certainly reasonable that he could have recognized Mr. Johnson's photo in the photo lineup from just having seen him around. He did the pizza delivery man did not see the person who robbed him until after the robbery, when he went and got in his car and drove around and saw a man later who identified as Mr. Johnson. When the actual robbery occurred, he testified to this, that he never saw the robber's face. So you have a after-the-fact identification. You have inconsistent identification. You have his reliance on Mr. Johnson having a receding hairline. His testimony at the trial was that Mr. Johnson had a receding hairline, and that's why he recognized him. Yet there was no mention of a receding hairline when he gave a description of the robber that night to the police. And, in fact, the police report checks that the robber had an Afro hairdo. And again, even without the inconsistencies in the eyewitness testimony, there's no way to quantify the impact of the confession to the murder. Again, this was a very, very small part of a very long trial, and where the bulk of the evidence in the trial was that Mr. Johnson killed a man. And if that confession had been properly excluded, the whole tenor of this case would have changed.
There was quite compelling evidence by Mr. Rodriguez that he followed Johnson, had many opportunities to look at him in that period of time. So is it unreasonable for the state to have concluded that no way would he have been acquitted?
Well, yes, I still believe it's unreasonable because you have to look at whether the confession played into the jury's, had any effect on the jury's verdict. And I think I've got some quotes from the United States Supreme Court talking about how compelling a confession is. The other, with respect to the victim's identification of Mr. Johnson, he never told that to the police. The first time he ever said that he played this cat and mouse game where he saw, where he identified Mr. Johnson on numerous occasions right there after the robbery, he said at the trial. When he was interviewed that night by the police, he never said that anything happened from the time of the robbery until the time he made the police report. And again, those are all factors which go into play as to the reliability of the eyewitness identification. And in addition to the these factors of unreliability, there's the fact that the confession was integral to the murder case, to the death penalty case that was going on at the same time this robbery was being tried. And again, you have to say, this is a jury who originally was looking at a murder and three robbery counts, and only convicts Mr. Johnson of one robbery. You don't know how much it was a factor that, well, we can't decide on anything else. We've got this one robbery, you know, he confessed to it. Let's go with that. At least we get him for something kind of thing.
Back to what he told the police. Did he found this policeman, and did the policeman came to the site where he had been following the fellow, didn't he at that point say that he'd been following the man?
No. No. And, in fact, the defense called that police officer in the defense case to establish just that fact. After he was robbed, he flagged down a police officer. The police officer went in search of the robber, and so did the victim. After, then the victim supposedly had these interactions with this little cat and mouse game in the car with the robber, and then met back up with the police officer at the site of the robbery where they actually did the police report. And at that time, he did not say that he had had any interactions with the robber from the time he had seen the police officer immediately before that. That, again, also, and that was established by the defense. I'm going to reserve the last minute for rebuttal.
Surely. Mr. Robbins.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, California Deputy AG Corey Robbins for appellee. Your Honors, while counsel has pointed to several different reasonable interpretations of the record, I think, as Your Honors were noting, we can't really say that the California court's interpretation of the facts here and of the applicable federal law was unreasonable. And I think that would be the end of the inquiry under the governing standards here today.
Are we applying Brecht?
If Your Honors find that the California courts erroneously, the California Court of Appeal erroneously applied Chapman, then I think Your Honors would apply Brecht or would review the district court's ruling under Brecht. This is a de novo review of the district court's legal conclusions. I think the district court did correctly apply Brecht. So I would be confident Your Honors would reach the same conclusion. But even before getting there, I don't think we can really say that the California courts unreasonably applied Chapman. While they might not have used the magic words from Chapman, I think finding it inconceivable that excluding the confession would have affected the result is basically the same thing as what Chapman requires. I do think that the district court correctly applied the Brecht standard. It identified the Brecht standard. It distinguished it from the Chapman standard. It discussed what was required under Brecht. And at the very end, it did mention reasonable probability. But I know that this court in Baines v. Canberra noted that under California law, certain trial errors are reviewed under the Watson standard, which is a reasonable probability standard. And in Baines, this court cited to United States Supreme Court precedent and noted that the Watson standard, the reasonable probability standard, is equivalent to the Brecht standard. So I think in referring to a reasonable probability, the district court did not deviate from the proper standard. It noted the proper standard, and it correctly applied it. So again, I think under the governing standards, you know, if we were in an original fact-finding position, then I think counsel's arguments would maybe be deserving of different type of scrutiny. But in this type of proceeding, given the standards, the well-known standards applicable here, I think we cannot find that the state court's treatment of this was unreasonable.
All right, Mr. Robbins, thank you very much. Mr. Esner.
Short and easy. Thank you.
There is error with everything the state court said with respect to the harmlessness. First, the court says, and they wrote so little, I'm going to read it here, that Rodriguez's uncontroverted testimony establishes that he had ample opportunity to observe Johnson during the robbery as well as afterward. That is false. While he did say he observed that he observed the robber afterwards, his testimony was that he never saw the face of the robber during the robbery itself. So factually, the state court was in error. Then they identify that the robber identified Mr. Johnson from the photo spread, and that he was 100% sure that Johnson was the man who robbed him. That's correct. And then concludes that it's clear that the jurors did not rely on Johnson's confession. If they had, they would have convicted Johnson of the other charges, since he confessed to all of them. On this record, it is inconceivable that the exclusion of the confession would have changed the result. Now, all three of those statements are erroneous. As I said, we don't know what the jury hung on. It's most likely that they hung between first and second degree murder, not that they hung on guilt or innocence. But in any event, at least some of the jurors believe the confession. It's only if it even had an effect on one juror, the confession, then the error wasn't harmless. They make no discussion of the fact that this was a death penalty case, that this was a murder case, that the murder case was contingent on almost completely on the confession. Nor do they discuss at all the numerous inconsistencies in the eyewitness testimony. And so while they make some blanket statements, they're incomplete, partially erroneous, and objectively unreasonable for the reasons that I cited. Thank you.
All right, counsel, thank you both for your argument. The matter just argued will be submitted.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Grace of Love and Love, representing 99 Cent Only Stores.
Good morning, Mr. Grace.
This case raises important issues with respect to the duty of district court judges to honor the requirements of Rules 68 and 65D. The result in this case could have a tremendous impact on whether a reasonable defendant in an intellectual property case can induce an overly aggressive plaintiff to accept a fair settlement.
You know what, I just don't understand the premise, because a Rule 68 offer of judgment is up to the crafter. In here, the crafter put in language that plainly allowed the district judge to exercise discretion with respect to the terms of the injunction. Now, I've never seen a Rule 68 offer with that term in it, so I can't imagine that it would have very widespread impact beyond this particular case.
Well, Your Honor, in this case,
like, I'm not even sure it's a Rule 68 offer, because Rule 68 offers are normally saying, you know, judgment can be entered against me for $10,999.99. Without any kinds of other things to be decided.
Well, Your Honor, I understand your point on that, and perhaps Rule 68 shouldn't apply to offers of injunctive relief, but other circuit court cases have recognized the applicability
right.
of Rule 68 when it includes, when an offer includes an offer of injunctive relief.
Right.
And other circuit court cases have said that when an offer includes an offer
and,
of injunctive
and the judgment offer could have done that, couldn't it? I mean, it could have said, we offer to have judgment entered against us as follows, quote, and quoted it.
That's true, Your Honor. It could have done that, and you can always do something better when you're in this particular case. I came into the case late, and we were running up against a trial date that had been set very short by the trial judge, and things were happening very quickly. And the question is, in this case, the trial judge, based upon an offer that reads...
Your key is the very last phrase. You're saying that the discretion extended to permanently enjoining the defendant from further sale or distribution of the allegedly infringing products, which was a limited
That's correct,
world of products. And, it's, and so the question is whether the discretion was exercised as to the allegedly infringing products or was exercised about something else that the offer didn't mention.
Why don't you tell us what discretion you think the district court judge had faced with this offer?
Well, I think he had, well, first of all, if you look at the proposed injunctions submitted by the parties, all of them are by definition longer than this one paragraph. They contain an identification of the parties, an identification of the case, the factual basis under Rule 65D for an injunction, which is the parties have agreed to the injunction, and there's consent, and it's limited to specific products. And so he has to craft all those things. It's still a short injunction, but the injunction we submitted is about 2 pages long, containing a variety of additional terms, which in a normal case the parties wouldn't necessarily disagree about. But in this case, I felt we were dealing with a very overly aggressive and unreasonable plaintiff, and that I didn't want to get into a lot of arguments about whether inconsequential provisions were enough to make the offer invalid. So what we tried to do was we set forth the key deal points of the offer, which was $15,000, covering everything, including costs, attorney's fees, and everything else, to get out of the way of those other Rule 68 cases, and an injunction with respect to the allegedly infringing products. And any clarifications beyond that or any other details that needed to be left, the trial court was free to add.
Maybe it would be helpful. I must have seen, probably not 100, but certainly dozens of injunctions in my life in copyright or trademark infringement suits, and they all look about like this, almost exactly like it. I mean, I could have practically dictated it. Save for perhaps one phrase, which is an I2D, and it is are sponsored or endorsed by Mattel, or authorized by Mattel, or. And that phrase strikes me as being somewhat broader than just an injunction to stop using the products that infringe the Mattel action toy or the thumbs up logo or the trade dressing or packaging on those products. But except possibly for that phrase, what's remarkable about the actual injunction that you're faced with?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, in the factual context, this was a lawsuit that was filed against a retailer after they had sold all the products.
I understand it's making a mountain out of a molehill from your point of view. I get that.
Okay,
but
then
the
let
point
me
is, what's the real, honest-to-God, real-world problem with the injunction?
Okay, let me try to address that. First of all, the injunction contains two paragraphs in which the judge says that 99 Cents acknowledges the validity and ownership of various rights of Mattel, including trade dress and copyright in packaging and products shown in exhibits that are 50 pages long. For the life of me, to this date, I have no idea what the claimed trade dress of Mattel was.
But the thing is, if you don't acknowledge that, then what value is the agreement to avoid infringing them? I mean, they put the exhibits in so that you know what it is that you can't infringe. And as I read the background, in fact, your client had at some point asked for pictures so that you'd know exactly what it is that you're infringing.
Well, Your Honor, we asked for pictures because we could not discern what the trade dress and copyrights that were theoretically infringed consisted of. And we were trying to clarify what the injunction were. And during that period of time, there were quite a few different settlement proposals. I was taking the position there shouldn't be an injunction at all. This was a customer of Mattel. This was a de minimis amount of product by a company that had no involvement in its development. They were saying they wanted a really onerous injunction. We were made a variety of different proposals. And in the end, we decided, because we came to an impasse, we sent an offer that said, okay, you can have an injunction that prohibits further sale and distribution of the allegedly infringing products, which from my point of view is, if the case had gone to trial and was a disputed issue with respect to whether an injunction was appropriate, they shouldn't have gotten an injunction at all. But if they're going to get an injunction, it would be don't do that again. Not don't ever violate any rights with respect to this whole product line that takes 50 pages to depict. Don't violate any of these very vague trademark rights of super action, thumbs up. Don't.
Well, but that's what the complaint was about.
Pardon?
I mean, that is what the complaint is about.
Well, the complaint discusses all those issues, but the complaint contains a number of causes of actions that were just flat-right frivolous. They sued us for trademark counterfeiting based on unregistered marks. You can't. That's no such cause of action.
I understand that. But
this was a small case in which the plaintiffs over-litigated the case. They had a big, huge complaint about a little, tiny matter. And then the judge basically came in, and if he's going to exercise his discretion, pursuant to that, if you're going to ignore the limitation and read it right out of the offer, there's no mention of the allegedly infringing products in the injunction. There's no factual finding that this is an ambiguous offer. If you are going to say this is an ambiguous offer and therefore I'm going to go beyond the language of it, then we get into Cali and we need to have an evidentiary hearing and findings of fact. There's no findings of fact in this case. There was no evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, to get you back to what the original question was, which was, what in the injunction do you object to? You object to the part which says that you concede that these products are trademarked or licensed. What else do you object to?
Well, the most egregious aspects of the injunction are the findings that we acknowledge the validity of things that I don't even know what they are. Because a Rule 60, the cases are, a Rule 68 offer is an offer.
Okay, just identify, you object to that. Do you object to anything else?
Well, yes, Your Honor. We basically object to the whole thing. I mean, if you want me to pick out the worst parts of it. But overall, the worst part of it is it's a 57-page injunction that basically gives Mattel the right
to
drag.
It's about a 4- or 5-page injunction with a lot of pictures, most of which you wanted. You know, saying it's 57 pages doesn't, you know, we're not here to add up things. Could you just tell us what language in the injunction is the problem?
Your Honor, I understand. But part of my frustration is you're saying we wanted it. There was no evidentiary finding.
Tell us what's in there.
The parts that are most egregious are the findings that we acknowledge the validity of disputed rights, which we did not acknowledge those, and most of those were not at issue in the case.
In other words, you're talking about paragraphs E and F under.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Paragraphs E and F. And then the most egregious provision is the one that Judge Reimer identified, which is the one that prohibits the sale of any.
Okay. What would happen if we struck out in part I to D? If you've got it there, what would happen if we just struck out the phrase are sponsored or endorsed by Mattel or authorized by Mattel so that the whole phrase would be likely to cause confusion with goods connected in some way with Mattel's trademarks, Max Steel, Super Action, and Thumbs Up?
That would be a vast improvement over where we are, Your Honor.
Okay.
But going back to the more core issue.
Would my discretion be properly exercised in doing that?
You have the right to a de novo review, and you have the right to instruct the trial judge to enter an injunction on the terms offered by the plaintiff. I represent the plaintiff. I don't think that goes far enough to meet the terms offered by the plaintiff, but I think the answer is yes, that would help, and yes, I think you can do that.
Okay.
But I think the issue here is that everyone wants to just completely ignore the operative key phrase with respect to the scope of the injunction and treat it as though it doesn't exist. Mattel's point of view is this was a roll of the dice. You said judge's discretion, therefore the judge can do whatever he wants. And there's other cases, the Guillermo case and other cases in which the Ninth Circuit has rejected that argument. It said just because there's a provision that provides for some exercise of discretion by the trial judge, doesn't mean the judge can ignore the operative provisions of the agreement. And when you apply California laws of construction to this, you have to go through and harmonize the provisions and say, what role does each provision have? So if he has complete discretion to do whatever he wants, then the last phrase has no provision. It's being read right out of the contract.
May I ask you a totally different question? I take it that no Rule 60B motion was made.
No, Your Honor,
in
we
the district
not make
court.
A Rule 60B motion.
Because there's a lot of sprinkling through some of the cases is the notion that Rule 60B is the proper way to challenge a Rule 68 judgment. So you didn't give the district court, you didn't make this pitch to the district court.
We did not think it would be helpful to go back before Judge Wilson with a Rule 60B motion. And Your Honor, I know you can do that when the judge makes a mistake, but in this case, there was no evidentiary hearing. There are no findings of fact supporting the injunction. He just signed what Mattel put in front of him. The first part of our argument is it's clear on its face that the operative phrase is what the operative phrase is. The second part of it is if there was going to be a dispute about what the settlement agreement was supposed to be, and people have long lawsuits with 2 months of trials over the meaning of a word and whether something's capitalized or not. If there was going to be a dispute, then the judge should have at least given us the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing, to at least have a hearing for him to talk about what it meant, because there was no hearing. There was just 2 simultaneous briefs, and he had to make factual findings.
Did you ever ask for a hearing?
No, we never had a hearing, Your Honor. He went and at the pretrial conference, when informed that there...
The answer to my question would be no, we never asked for a hearing.
Oh, yes, we did ask for a hearing, Your Honor. In our opposition to their, we made 3 points, pretty much the same 3 points we're making now, that is plain on its face, that Mattel's arguments that it's ambiguous should be rejected and they should not be able to introduce evidence about the prior settlement negotiations. But if they are going to do that, we want an evidentiary hearing and the opportunity to cross-examine their witnesses. That was the second point in our the brief we filed. And then the third point was our same third point here, which is their proposed injunction violates every one of the requirements of Rule 65D. It's not, there's no finding supporting the scope of the injunction. It's not specific to a specific threat and harm. And it doesn't describe in reasonable detail what the prohibited conduct is supposed to be. We're talking about a retailer, which is a $1 billion business.
I thought the problem was it described it in too great detail.
Well, you know, I know people get away with getting defendants to sign things like this all the time. That doesn't make it right in the context of a dispute that was all about whether there was going to be an injunction in the future. My client's a $1 billion company on the New York Stock Exchange, and it didn't want to roll over and just acquiesce to what an unreasonable plaintiff wanted to do. So we have a case with a wealthy, overly aggressive plaintiff, and a retailer who has the resources to say, look, if you're going to shove this down my throat, I'm at least entitled to what the rules require. And the rules, I think, require the judge to give force to each part of the Rule 68 offer, including the part that specified the scope of the injunction, and including his obligation, which judicial discretion is not whatever you want to do. Judicial discretion is pursuant to the rules of civil procedure, which under the Federal Election Commission cases and a multitude of other cases, if you're going to have an injunction without the consent of the other party, it has to satisfy those three requirements.
And you wrote a letter, which said that the judge would determine the scope of the injunction.
I think that was in-house counsel for 99 cents, and that was, there was one of the proposals at the time was, let's just present a joint report or otherwise present everything to the judge and let the judge decide what's appropriate. But that was in one of the other types of procedures. That didn't happen in this case. We did not do a stipulation of stipulated facts and present it to the court with a joint report about arguments of what the judge should or shouldn't do. We had a much different procedure in which we had a Rule 68 offer. They submitted a proposed judgment. We showed up, the judge said you can each exchange simultaneous briefs on what it means, and then we ended up with a 57 pages plus 50 pages of exhibits. However you want to look at it, it's a thick piece of paper for a corporation to have to put into its mentality and try to remember forever. And based upon $9,000 of little toy soldiers, I think it's completely inappropriate. I'm going to save my last 3 minutes
for
rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Grace.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jill Petrini for Appellee Mattel. May it please the Court. First, I'd like to address the appealability of a Rule 68 offer that has been accepted. And there seems to be sort of a semantics situation in the cases that I've read, whether it's a jurisdictional issue or it's a waiver of error. And either way, we shouldn't be before you, because our position is that by agreeing to the offer and not reserving a right of appeal, then 99 Cent Store has in fact waived any claimed errors in the injunction.
Doesn't that presume the answer? I mean, their position is they didn't consent to the entry of this judgment.
Well, what it boils down to is they don't like the one that Judge Wilson chose. We presented two.
Well, let's pretend it was more clear. Let's say they agreed to pay $10,000 and the district court said, gee, I think it's worth $15,000, and put that in. Would they be precluded from appealing that?
Then they would have to file a Rule 60 motion on mistake and error, and then the right of appeal would attach there, because then you're talking about effectively almost a typographical error.
In my hypothetical, the judge just didn't like it.
Just did something
different. Is that a consented judgment? Or is that some other kind of judgment that a person can appeal from within the normal 30 days?
I think at that point, then, they would probably have a right of appeal. because here the difference here that we're having is that we gave the discretion to the judge because we could not agree.
Well, their position is that they gave the judge an inch and he took a mile, that the discretion was to deal with the specifically infringing products, not with a bunch of other products.
Well, their position is not supported by the transcript. I mean, it was very clear.
I'm looking at the written offer, the last phrase of the written offer, which
says, I understand that.
Permanently enjoining defendant for further sale or distribution of the allegedly infringing products, which are the ones that led to the $15,000.
I think we would be helped by telling us what it says in the complaint were the alleged infringing products.
What were the...
Because certainly you couldn't go broader than that, isn't that right?
Well, that's what we knew about at the time that we filed the complaint, that they had these Fox Steel complete knockoff of the Max Steel product. But the prayer was, we don't want you to sell those or use that mark, Fox Steel, or any other mark that's confusingly similar to Max Steel. That is very standard in a trademark case that is right in the Lanham Act.
Well, but the language is the alleged infringing products. And how do you describe those alleged infringing products in your complaint?
As the Fox Steel action figures. But if this...
Hey, can you give us the language?
Yeah, it's Fox Steel action figures. It's on pages 8 and 9 of the complaint.
Yes. Maybe you just read it to us.
Sure. Defendants, at some point prior to the day of the complaint, defendants began manufacturing, marketing, and advertising and selling and distributing an action figure bearing the marks Fox Steel and Design, Super Action and Design, and a colorable imitation of the Thumbs Up logo that is nearly an exact copy of the sculpture for Max Steel Mountain Attack action figure and the packaging, therefore.
So why isn't the Rule 68 offer to have a permanent injunction that says you may never again sell, and then that phrase?
Well, you can't look at that Rule 68 offer in a vacuum. 99 Cent Store wants you to do that, and that's just not right, because what happened was that this was a settlement impasse. We came down to, we had all the terms agreed to, including validity, everything else that's in the injunction that was, in fact, entered by Judge Wilson. And it came down to the words infringe versus substantially similar. And they wanted infringe, and I said, no, you need substantially similar. And then they came with their Rule 68 offer and said, okay, we'll let the judge decide. But you can't just look at the last parts of that 68 offer. You have to look at the terms that says in the district court's discretion. He's going to fill in the terms. That
was but he can't go beyond the alleged infringing products, can he?
Yes, he can, because that's right in the Lanham Act. And they agreed to that 2 hours after that offer of judgment was sent. They said, we remain willing and ready to not sell those products or anything confusingly similar to it. That was part of the deal. And they're trying to make this that, oh, it's only the infringing products. Well, you know what? That's just an action figure. If I change it and put it on a box of pins,
what exactly is the practical difference between, let's say they now sell something that is completely different, that's, I don't know, little combs and brushes that has nothing to do with action figures, but it happens to be, in your view, infringing of a different Mattel product. You can sue them again. So what difference does it make to you as a practical matter whether you sue them again over the hairbrushes or whether you say, aha, you violated the injunction, so now we're going to go in and enforce the injunction? Why?
Well, because we have to initiate a whole new action versus a motion for contempt, and we still have to make our proof on the contempt.
Well, that's my point exactly. You still have to make the same proof. So why? This seems like on both sides, if I might say so, from my perspective, a mountain out of a molehill.
It's very important to us. These were so similar. It was amazing. It was the exact same packaging.
They admit that.
No, I understand that. But we want to be able to have something that's enforceable. Each time we have to keep suing our customer or suing someone else, if it's within the scope of our prayer, of the injunction, of what we went after the first time, why should we have to continually police these guys in separate actions.
Well, if you'd won the litigation after a trial, you might not have to. But the question here is, when they cry uncle, what did they cry uncle to is the question, not whether you could have won something broader had you gone all the way through the process.
But it wasn't – what you're forgetting is everything that happened before. We were all in agreement that it was or confusingly similar or substantially similar. That's what it came down to. That was the dispute that we turned over voluntarily at Mr. Grace's and his client's proposal to have him decide. We agreed on the money. We couldn't agree on the terms and the scope and the definition of the injunctive language, and we turned it over to him. And that is well within the Lanham Act.
What do you think of my rewrite?
Your rewrite, if you take out that language?
Mm-hmm.
We could live with that, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that goes a long ways toward solving this whole mess.
It's modified. I understand your point. I listened, obviously, in the question of Mr. Grace. I think that phrase is modified by the Max Steel. And
it may not be. So if you take it out, that solves the problem and keeps it just down to the Max Steel figures.
Right, or any products that are confusingly similar.
Or confusingly
right,
similar
exactly.
to them.
Because we did not, and the implication that we wanted this injunction to cover every single trademark that Mattel owns is ridiculous. It's in the context of the case. All the language relates back to our trademarks that we alleged. And we just don't want them to be able to change one letter or use, it's not an action figure, but it's a lunchbox, and use the exact same mark, and then we're back filing a lawsuit, which should be able to enforce the injunction that was negotiated. And that's just, it's absolutely clear from the correspondence where we were at and what we turned over to the district court judge. One point I'd like to make, and I think that you raised it, Your Honor, was whether a request for a hearing was made. It was not. It was very clear at the pretrial conference that if we wanted a hearing, we could have asked for it. Judge Wilson prompted the parties, do you want me to conduct a mini trial? And no one requested it. And it was after the fact that the brief was made by 99 Cent Store where they said, well, if you're going to consider the correspondence, the pre-November 2nd correspondence, then we want the ability to cross-examine witnesses. Well, of course Judge Wilson was going to consider the correspondence. I said that. I had it with me at the hearing, and we talked about it. And he said that, you know, he wanted us to submit our briefs and which version we wanted and everything we were going to put in. At that point was your time to request the hearing. And it wasn't.
So you're saying he requested it, but he did it too late?
No, he did not request it.
You agreed that it was in the brief, that if he was going to go beyond X, then he should hold a hearing.
This is the reference that he makes. He says, and this is on page 9, and it's Exhibit 7 in the excerpt filed by 99 Cent Store. He says, there is no need for testimony about the meaning and scope of the offer, and such testimony would be improper and inconsistent with the very purpose of Rule 68 to put an end to litigation. Further, this is what he's relying upon. If there is to be testimony, 99 Cent should have the opportunity to offer witnesses and to cross-examine the witnesses pro-offered by Mattel. And then he goes on to some other stuff that doesn't really matter. That's what he's saying, that was his request for hearing. That's not a request for hearing, and it's contrary to what he said to Judge Wilson at the pretrial conference. He says, Judge Wilson says, you've agreed that I'm to fill in the terms. Your Honor, we're fine with that, but with one caveat, that we wouldn't want it to be based on the pre-November 2nd proposals that we rejected. He knew that's what we were going to do. And if he wanted a hearing, what would you have a hearing on? I mean, it was correspondence between the attorneys. We were going back and forth trying to negotiate the settlement, and we just came to an impasse, and we decided to turn it over to the judge to end the case. If there's not anything else?
I don't think so.
Okay. We've got plenty of time left.
Thank you. Mr. Grace?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is them. Actually, Max Steel is about a G.I. Joe type of a doll, but these are the guys who was $9,000 worth of these. What would we want a hearing for? It was Mattel's position that the offer was ambiguous. Our position was that it wasn't ambiguous, that you're supposed to read the Rule 68 offer and effectuate the plain meaning of it. It was Mattel that was saying it was ambiguous, and if they were going to say that it was ambiguous,
then we should have a hearing about whether it's ambiguous and whether the two meanings are supported by factual showing or not. She's standing up here making a whole bunch of statements about facts of what I said, what she said. There was no hearing about that. There were no factual findings about that. And I disagree with her about that.
Well, let me ask you something. There were no declarations or anything.
Your Honor, there were declarations. The way this
beyond the correspondence.
That were submitted to the judge. No, each party did submit some declarations. She submitted a declaration identifying their supplemental excerpts of record. Is her declaration with seven, however many.
I know. That's just a standard form. Here's the stuff that's attached, right? Kind of declarations. It's not a he said, she said fight.
Well, there is a he said, she said fight because at the time I was saying we shouldn't have an injunction at all. The in-house counsel at 99 Cents.
Which is clear from reading this.
Well, he was saying the in-house counsel at 99 Cents, who was at the hearing, who spoke before Judge Wilson, said we should submit stipulated facts in a joint report and let the judge make a decision based upon the stipulated facts in a joint report. And Mattel was saying we'll just submit it and let the judge do whatever he wants to do. And this submission, we've never seen all the exhibits to the proposed injunction before they were submitted to the court. We've certainly never agreed to it ahead of time. And part of the reason we were asking for it is because we couldn't understand what their claims were with respect to trade dress and copyrights. Once we saw the exhibits, we still don't know what they are, and now it's even worse because you can't tell what they're claiming their trade dress is, and they don't identify their copyrights. And to go back to your point, I represent plaintiffs in intellectual property cases. I can confess to being as guilty as anybody else. We always extract a pound of flesh when despite whether the dispute is a minor dispute or a big dispute. What's different in this case is the defendant wasn't willing to roll over. So this is a perfect case for the court to take this on and say, Rule 68 is to protect defendants. And the trial judge should effectuate Rule 68 in the way it's supposed to be effectuated, is to give the defendant a fair shake, not just to latch on to some loose language in it and go say, well, it's arguably ambiguous, so I can do anything I want to do. His arguably ambiguous rationale, if he had one, because he made no findings, basically writes the operative provision of the Rule 68 offer right off the paper. Doesn't show up anywhere in the injunction. It might as well not have been included in the offer. And that's what we were trying to do, was we were saying we won't do this again. Not that we're never going to violate your rights. And if we do, we're right up the street from you. You know where we live. We're a New York Stock Exchange company. You can come find us. You can bring it up. We're your customer. You can send us a nice letter. There's no reason to have a 57-page document, and however you want to characterize it as language and photographs, there's no reason for a 57-page document in this litigation case. And if the rules are going to have any meaning in terms of protecting defendants, then I think that the court needs to send a message to Judge Wilson that you needed to give these guys a fair shake. I think my time is up, so I'll say thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, both of you, for your argument. And the matter just argued will be submitted. And before hearing the next two matters on calendar, the court will take a brief recess.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ali Kamari, appearing on behalf of Appellant Kalantari. May it please the Court. Your Honor, the basics of this issue is there's a question with regard to contracts entered into by Mr. Kalantari, the plaintiff in this case, with Iranian entities to obtain rights to show motion pictures of Iranian origin in the United States and Canada. We essentially have three contracts. One contract has a single upfront payment provision. Two contracts have a upfront payment provision as well as royalty-based provisions. Based on the assignments that Mr. Kalantari obtained, he applied for and obtained registrations from the United States Copyright Office, and the name of the owners of the entities in Iran are on the copyright registrations. The motion pictures, which are mostly in the Farsi language, are directed to the Farsi-speaking community of the United States and Canada. Plaintiff Kalantari then advertised those motion pictures by indicating the time, place, and dates of the showing of the motion pictures, and also charged patrons for attending those theaters.
Could you help me a bit on the actual copyright aspect? You say that the name of the Iranian company is on the copyright registration certificates?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you obtained them how?
Your Honor, it's the very simple process. The application is submitted to the Copyright Office. It is indicated on there who has assigned, who is the author of the motion pictures.
Which is Iranian.
That's correct. Also on the copyright registrations, it is indicated that Iran is the country of national origin of the owners of the registration that has been assigned to Mr. Kalantari. That application is submitted to the United States Copyright Office. The United States Copyright Office is not a rubber stamping facility. They do analyze to see whether there is a right to issue that registration. Once they make that determination, they will issue the registration. And, Your Honor, the main piece of legislation which is important in this case is the IEPA, which is the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. This act gives broad powers to the president to regulate trade with countries which there's a perception that there is a threat to the national security of the United States. However, from the IEPA, Congress has carved out exceptions. And most notably, it is indicated that the authority granted to the president by this section does not include the authority to regulate or prohibit, directly or indirectly, the importation from any country or the exportation to any country, whether commercial or otherwise, regardless of format or medium, any information or informational materials, which by definition includes also films. Now, there's three important notes about the IEPA. Number one, it does not make a distinction between importation or exportation. That is, necessarily, if there's a restriction on importation, that restriction will also apply to exportation. Number two, there's no distinction between countries under the regulation and countries outside of the regulations. There's no special rules for countries that are within the regulation and what can be done, and rules applying for countries that are not under the regulation and what can be done. They're both treated equally. The third important thing is that Congress balanced the rights of the First Amendment of Americans against any threat that the embargoes could possibly cure, and it determined that the First Amendment rights of Americans was more important. In fact, according to the House Conference Report, it has indicated that commercial information materials were exempted from the general prohibitions of the regulations to ensure that the embargo did not ban or restrict the import or export of information protected under the First Amendment. That's House Conference Report Number 103-482. Now, that is the congressional act that takes us to the regulations of Part 31 CFR 560, which is the Iranian transaction regulations promulgated by the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC. There's four sections in these regulations which are important. 560.210, which is entitled Exempt Transactions, Part C, subpart C of that indicates, again, the same thing that I read from the IEPA, namely that the exportation or importation of information, informational materials, is exempt from these regulations. The second important thing is 560.210C2, which indicates that there are still two things that are still prohibited. One is a provision for marketing and business consulting services, and also incomplete works. But in this case, first of all, the copyrights are completed works. But it also actually authorizes prepayments for incomplete works such as periodicals, etc. The other section, which is important, is 560.509. It says all of the following transactions in connection with patent, trademark, copyright, or other intellectual property in the United States or Iran are authorized. And pursuant to this section, it gives the Iranian entity to register patents, trademarks, and copyrights in the United States and to enforce those registrations. It also is bilateral. In other words, it allows U.S. entities to apply for patents, trademarks, and copyrights in Iran and to enforce those registrations in Iran.
Counsel, how do you understand the phrase marketing in Part C2? It seems to be within the context of information and informational materials.
It's not, Your Honor. It is talking about you can't do marketing and business consulting for that type of work or to promote that type of work. In fact, we've referred to, the defendants and the appellees' assignments, which have marketing and business consulting provisions in them. marketing business consulting is I receive something of value and I will promote your work. In this case, all plaintiff counter did was he's paying money. He's not receiving anything. He's paying money to obtain the motion pictures, and what he's doing is he's promoting his own motion pictures, the showing of them in the United States, which again is commercial speech and squarely within the First Amendment rights.
It's marketing, but not marketing services.
That's correct. It is not marketing services for entities in Iran. It is only advertising the showing of the motion pictures and something about the motion pictures while it's advertising in the U.S.
To an extent, however, the success of the marketing impacts the amount of money that the Iranian entity gets paid. So
that is true, Your Honor.
Therefore, it has an interest in successful marketing.
Well, again, there's a difference. There's a line here. If and I could point to the line which, for example, the defendants, what they did was they said, we get an assignment, we show the motion pictures, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to say we're going to promote all kinds of good stuff about Iranian movie industry, about Iranian actors and actresses. But that's not what the plaintiff and the appellant did in this case. What he said was, we will bring in the motion picture, we show it, and all he did, and all the evidence shows, is the only thing that he did, he advertised time, place, and date of the showing of the motion pictures, which are squarely within First Amendment rights. He also indicated a brief synopsis of the storyline of the motion picture, and he indicated whether the motion picture had won any rights or acclaim in international film festivals. That's the basis of all his activities in promoting the motion picture and the showing. And all of those activities are squarely within the First Amendment rights. Those has been determined by a number of cases on commercial speech, and is still, again, regulations don't even apply. Congress has balanced the rights itself between First Amendment rights and between anything that might happen under the embargo as far as trade regulations, and has determined that the President does not even have the power to directly or indirectly ban or restrict the importation of informational materials.
If I understand the heart of NITV's argument, it is that all of that aside, what you didn't have a right to is to an assignment of the copyright such that you have the exclusive right to publish, distribute, et cetera.
Your Honor, as I said, either all of them.
And they are quite correct that neither the statute nor the regulations explicitly in terms exempts or allows assignment of copyright.
Your Honor,
right.
No, I think that's incorrect, Your Honor. First of all, as I mentioned, there's 560.509. Now, either all of Calentari's activities fall within the First Amendment rights and are not subject to regulations.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. Just say again.
Either all of his activities fall within First Amendment rights, which are not.
Well, no, wait a minute. We're not into Constitution land here. We're into specific regulatory regime.
Well, Your Honor, that's the whole point. Is
well, that may have been the point for doing it, but that doesn't answer the question about who has the ability to convey copyrights. Let us suppose, put differently, you have the unquestioned right to buy the film.
Correct.
Okay. And pay for it.
That's correct.
Okay. And perhaps have the right to use it.
Correct.
Because otherwise, why would you buy it?
Correct.
But if I understand NITV's pitch, it is that you do not have the right to acquire exclusive copyright rights in these films, such that other uses in this country can be prohibited by you.
Your Honor, as I'm trying to explain, if the Iranian entity did not have, the original Iranian entity in that, did not have that right in the United States, you would be absolutely correct. But that right has been conferred 560.509 says all of the following transactions in connection with patent, trademark, copyright, or other intellectual property protection in the United States or Iran are authorized. The filing and prosecution of any application to obtain a patent, trademark, or copyright. The authorization to pay for services, payment for such services, payment for...
Yeah, see, I've read this maybe 50 times, okay, so I know what it says. My problem, and what I'm looking to you to help me with, because you're the expert, is to explain to me what these words mean. Because I can't...
I'm sorry.
Just a second, okay? With specific reference to what your opponents say, which is that nowhere in here is there mention of an assignment of copyright rights to an American company. How do you tweak that right out of this set of words?
And I'm just trying to get that. I'll get to it fast, a little quicker. What I was trying to do is establish that the Iranian entity does have rights in the United States itself to obtain registrations and to enforce those registrations. Now, Section 560.405, number one, inherently, once that Iranian entity has that right, it could assign its right. If it didn't have its right, that right, it could not
assign
it. Well,
but you see, I'm not trying to quibble with you at all about the common sense of it, okay? What I'm trying to find is where you tweak that out of these words.
Okay. Section 560.405. Transactions.
560.405?
405, correct,
Ron. Okay.
Transactions incidental to a licensed transaction authorized.
Yes.
Any transaction ordinarily incident to a licensed transaction and necessary to give effect thereto is also authorized.
Yes.
In other words, this is a catch-all phrase not just for this licensed transaction, but also every other licensed transaction in which the government is saying, you know what? We can't sit here and run regulations little by little as to, well, this part of it you can do and this part of it you can't do.
I understand, but you could get a specific license to do it.
Assuming
the general license doesn't cover it, you could get a specific
license. If a general license is not applicable.
Okay. And you 509 is the general license.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the district court read this, and it's quite susceptible of the reading, that 509A1 just has to do with filing and obtaining a patent or a copyright. That's fairly straightforward. That is, we will let an Iranian entity get copyright protection in this country. That literally says nothing about whether it can use it or not, or assign it or not.
That portion of it is correct. The patent, trademark, copyright is never an authorization to engage in business.
Correct.
For example, we can apply for a drug patent, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you can market that drug unless the FDA approves it first. So that is absolutely correct. But what we indicated was, first of all, the district court said you can't even pay money for it. So the district court was in error. But all of the transactions, everything as far as purchasing the motion pictures, obtaining copyright registrations, commercially showing them in movie theaters, those are all transactions that are either licensed or they are within the First Amendment rights and not even subject to the regulations.
Okay, now are we talking the First Amendment here? Are we talking the fact that your license covers it? I did not understand your argument to be that you were dependent upon the umbrella of the First Amendment. I thought your argument was that it actually was within the scope of the general license.
Your Honor, we have been consistently arguing that, in fact, that's where the district court erred. The district court, we said these transactions are exempt from the regulations. The President does not even have the authority to regulate these transactions.
Okay. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm needlessly complicating things, and I apologize. I am beyond the exemption, okay? I don't think there's any question but what you can import that film, and you can pay for it.
Correct.
Okay, which you did. And if you used the film, presumably you would get in deep trouble with the entity and the Iranian entities. But that's not our problem. Our problem now is that you have sued NITV for copyright infringement, right?
That's correct.
And they're in turn saying, wait a minute, you can't enforce your copyright because it's illegal.
Well, like I said, Your Honor, the copyright registrations clearly indicate on them, number one, that it's an Iranian entity.
Yes.
Number two, the 560.509 clearly gives that Iranian entity the right to register copyrights as well as to enforce them. And second of
yes,
all...
Yes, but you're not it.
But we have... If the Iranian entity has the rights in the United States, that right can be assigned. And Section 560.405, it says any transaction ordinarily incident to a licensed transaction and necessary to give effect thereto is also authorized.
Okay, so now let me repeat this and see if I've got it right. The Iranian entity has the right to get copyright protection in this country.
That is correct.
Because it has the right to get copyright registration and got it, it necessarily has the right to distribute in this country itself?
Yes.
Itself.
No. That would be the First Amendment right of Mr. Kalantari as a U.S. entity to do so.
I see. So the Iranian company can't use its copyright to distribute or publish in this country. It has to go through an American.
If it becomes the American, correct, that is correct.
Boy. And so you're saying that because it has the copyright, even though it can't use the bundle of rights itself, it can assign them to an American for money.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
If you can have the under the First Amendment, the U.S. entity is allowed to purchase, bring in, commercially use, and distribute the motion pictures all under the First Amendment. If the government did not intend for there to be an exclusivity in that or a monopoly in that, then it simply could have said, you know what, I'm not going to issue the license for patent and trademark copyright exclusivity. Because it did that, then it gave the right, in other words, the licensing portion of the intellectual property is not within the First Amendment. That is within the clearly within the authority of the President to regulate. And through two administrations of President Clinton and President Bush, that authority has remained in place. So that gives the Iranian entity, therefore, the right to create and confer exclusivity. And based on that, it gave that exclusivity. Now it has the authority to give that exclusivity to Mr. Kalantari, who is a U.S. entity, and to be able to exercise his First Amendment rights. The government is free to take away that license, but it has not done so. In fact, with regard to certain countries, that license does not exist. Your Honor, I'll take the balance of my time if there's no question, if there's any questions that Mr. Reffitt can have.
Well, I'll give you time for rebuttal. I took a lot of it.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Martin Refkin for defendants and appellees, NITV, Inc., Zia Atabi, and Parveen Atabi. I want to divide my time into a couple of areas. I want to give you a general overview as I see this appeal. I want to talk about the First Amendment. I want to discuss the executive orders, and I want to apply all of that to the contracts herein. First of all, if this Court were to authorize the transactions that are involved here, we would have money legally going to unknown representatives for alleged agents of unknown assignees of alleged owners of films. Now, at the hearing on the summary judgment motion, counsel for Kalantari stated that, yes, money could conceivably go to fund international terrorism, but that is neither here nor there. And I submit that that is...
Well, why is it either here or there? Either something is a prohibited transaction or it isn't, and whether Congress has or has not created a loophole, they have or have not created it. So the ultimate question, whether a payment can be used for a bad purpose, really isn't the question before us, is it?
Well, it is, Your Honor, in that
we first must look at the executive orders, and the executive orders must be given the broadest of latitude. The language and the interpretation of those executive orders, you must look to the plain language of those in analyzing what here is allowed or not.
Help me through this. Let's start with the statute, which says that the authority granted to the President does not include authority to regulate or prohibit directly or indirectly the importation of a commercial film.
Absolutely. Okay.
So it comes in.
Absolutely.
And since commercial is there, presumably one can pay for it to someone in Iran who might or might not be a terrorist. Okay, so.
And royalties can be paid.
No. See, we have to draw a line here. The transactions involved here are not licensed transactions. They are not, either under 405, they're not licensed. They're clearly not exempt.
You say that, but why are they clearly not exempt?
Because
why aren't they? Let me finish the question.
Sorry.
The coverage talks about transactions in connection with copyright or other intellectual property protection in the United States or Iran. And it would seem to me that in connection with and the other intellectual property protection would be susceptible, at least, of a reading that would include licensing or assignment, rather, which is an ordinary incident of the copyright world. Why wouldn't it include in the transactions not prohibited the opportunity to assign the rights that are expressly granted there?
Because the executive orders themselves were designed as prohibitions, and the language in the executive orders are so broad, they could not think of every circumstance where one could avoid or attempt to evade the purpose of the embargo, and that is embodied in one of the sections. So when we look at 509, 509A simply says that these transactions in connection with, and I'll go through, in connection with copyrights are authorized, but what is authorized here?
Or other intellectual property protection, whatever that means.
I understand, but we're talking about copyrights here, so I'll ... through what we're not talking about. And under item number one, it only talks about the filing and prosecution of an application to obtain a copyright. So one may, under 509, apply for and prosecute an application to get a copyright. And you may pay for the importation of that film, and you may pay for services that are directly connected to that obtaining of the copyright. Now, arguably, profits are not services connected with the obtaining of the films.
Are you familiar with the Cuban regulations that are under the same statutory rubric?
Vaguely. I mean, I've read about regulations for China, for Cuba, just vaguely.
And the reason I ask that is that there is an example given in the regulations relating to Cuba that's almost identical to this case. It talks about a United States entity obtaining permission to paying for both upfront and royalties, paying for a master copy of a film and obtaining the exclusive rights to distribute it and so forth, and that being all okay. And I wonder, in your view, what is the difference, if there is one, between the Cuban regulations and the Iranian regulations, whether they should be interpreted differently, and if so, why?
Well, to begin with, I'm not that familiar with the Cuban regulations. I don't know if the Cuban regulations were designed to attempt to address the issue of international terrorism and the issue of the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction. There may be some trade issues involved, but the overall purpose for this embargo was based upon international terrorism. And I think we cannot.
But the statute that it's interpreting is identical. That's where the rubric is. The President has no power to prohibit or regulate directly or indirectly a category of transactions. And that statute applies across the board. And that's why I'm asking the question.
Well, if we're going to go to First Amendment, because that's the basis upon which it says that you cannot.
I didn't. I was asking about the statute. I'm trying to understand your view of the statute.
All right. I cannot address the statute that deals with the Cuban embargo. I'm just not familiar enough with that. But I can say that here, the only thing that is authorized by the regulations is the filing and prosecution of an application to obtain a copyright. It does not specifically authorize assignments. It does not specifically authorize commercialization of these films. If, in fact, the executive orders were intended to do so, then those activities would have been specifically exempted, as were the other activities in Section 210. 210 only has five items that are exempt, and to stretch the interpretation of 210, because the words all appear in there, commercial, importation, and exportation, and to change the meanings of those words or to say that commercialization applies to importation or there's an inherent right to commercialize these transactions flies in the face of the purpose for the Iranian transaction regulations. And we have to go back there, and we have to continue to look at the clear meaning of the statute here. Now, 405 says that any transaction incident to a license transaction, that begs the question, because this transaction, these transactions, are not licensed. The owner would have the right to come over and apply for and perhaps obtain a copyright. But the plaintiff, Mr. Kalantari here, did not have that right because, as the district court held, those transactions, those contracts, violated the spirit and the actual language of the embargo. Because, and what we need to look back at is, when those applications were made, only the English version of the six contracts was submitted. The Farsi contracts, which contain the matter that makes these transactions violate the embargo, those were not submitted.
What is the difference that, in your view, makes them prohibited or not?
The money going
royalty
back.
Royalty payments.
The profit payments going back to unknown people in Iran for unknown purposes. I find that to be the cornerstone of why the Iranian transaction regulations were enacted, just to prevent these. Now, if the plaintiff wanted to obtain a license, a specific license, he can go and apply. And there are plenty of exceptions to the embargo where one goes through the processes to obtain a license. And then presumably the Office of Foreign Asset Management Control then monitors these payments. But what we have here is admittedly money going to unknown people, and nobody knows
well,
what's happening.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume that you're correct, that royalties can't be paid to persons in Iran. How does that affect the validity of the copyright, the underlying copyright, and the exclusivity, the right to exclude others? I can't make a penny, but I can exclude you. Why wouldn't that still be permissible?
Because the right to obtain a copyright via assignment is a prohibited transaction, because it is a dealing, it is a transaction involving Iranian goods. Those words appear as part of the prohibitions. A transaction involving Iranian origin goods is prohibited.
Mr. Griffin, I have a spin on Judge Graber's question. The reason we're here is because you have asserted an illegality defense to an infringement of copyright action. It's copyright. Registration, an assertion of ownership, and there is nothing sort of on its face unlawful about enforcing a copyright. Why isn't what you're talking about simply a merits-based defense to their lack of ownership of the copyright?
because the actual assignments themselves, which give the basis for the copyrights, violate the embargo. They are illegal and unenforceable.
So they have a copyright. You're just saying it's a no-good copyright.
Well, they have a copyright because they went to the copyright.
They have a copyright. Absolutely. And you say that you're saying it shouldn't be recognized by the courts.
Yes, they have the copyright. It should not be recognized because the means by which they obtain the copyright violates the embargo. And therefore, all six of those contracts are illegal, unlawful, and unenforceable. And that's what the district court so held. If you don't have an enforceable contract, a legal contract, the court cannot enforce.
Well, that strikes me as being an attempt to regulate or prohibit directly or indirectly the importation of a commercial film, which is something that the president has no authority to do under the statute.
Okay. There is nothing that prohibits or prevents the film from coming into this country. Absolutely can. I absolutely concede that point, and the district court so found. The importation of the film is legal. But when you weigh whether they have the right to commercialize, which in essence is commercial free speech, that...
Why are we weighing anything? Either there's a regulation or a statute that says it's okay or not okay. I guess I don't understand what it is you want us to weigh and why that's our business.
Well, if we're going to look at the First Amendment and commercial free speech, then commercial free speech clearly occupies a lesser protective
status. Why aren't we
status.
Just looking at statutes and regulations and what they allow or they don't allow?
That's fine. I'm more than happy to look there. The issue of free speech and First Amendment was raised principally in the reply brief, and that's why I wanted to address it.
It may explain how the legislation came to be, but...
And that free speech and the regulations address the question of whether these films can be brought in, and absolutely... They can be brought in under the First Amendment or under the specific terms of the embargo. But there is no place in the embargo where it says that one who brings a movie in can commercially exploit that movie and can send money back to unknown people in Iran. I mean, that's the purpose for the embargo, is to prevent the money from going back unless it's licensed, which it isn't, unless there's a special license, which there wasn't one. So the only way that the embargo, A, makes sense, and B, can be enforced, is you have to draw a line. And the line has to be drawn where the money simply cannot go back into Iran to unknown people for who knows what purposes. That's where I think we have
but
to
But it can go
line.
Back for the film. So that's where it's hard for me to see the difference.
Well, under 509, you may pay for services directly connected to the obtaining of the copyright. You can't pay profits. You can pay for...
Why isn't that directly connected? Some people have contracts for a one-time payment and some people have royalties, but why isn't it still directly connected to the copyright?
Because all that is exempt in this transaction is the obtaining of a copyright. The commercialization of that copyright is not exempt. So, yes, even as the district court said, they can have that right to obtain the copyright. But and they could file suit if somebody was infringing on a lawful copyright.
Well, you just said they can get the copyright and pay for it. So what's illegal about the copyright?
The contract, which calls for the assignment and which calls for exclusivity, those acts...
What else is a copyright except exclusivity?
But if the President Clinton intended to allow for these transactions, then the whole ambit of copyright protection would have been excluded. And I think the language in 210 is very clear that marketing and business services are not exempt. I think it's very clear there. The man is marketing these films, and he's going a step further because he's sending the money back to unknown people in Iran. Those don't qualify.
Apparently you disagree then with the idea that marketing a product is different than providing marketing services. marketing a product that you have to sell is different than providing marketing services.
No, I don't disagree. Where I disagree is if Mr. Kalantari would have marketed this product, would have sold it here, and not sent money back to these unknown people in Iran, that those transactions would not have been subject to the embargo. That's where we draw the line, because you can just, the embargo says you can't engage in these transactions, you can't have these dealings, you can't have these investments. The language is very, very broad, and the language goes further to talk about including but not limited to. There's so many qualifiers or expanders, if you will, in the embargo, because you just couldn't think of all the ways in which somebody might try to avoid or evade the purpose of the embargo. And that's what we have here. We have this money going back, which either directly violates or it evades or it attempts to violate the embargo, all of which would make the transactions underlying the copyrights, the contracts, illegal and unenforceable. I see my light is almost in. Are there any other questions?
I don't think so.
I thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just a few points. First of all, as far as royalties are concerned, royalties are a very normal part of intellectual property contracts, whether it's the assignment of whether it's a licensing of a technology, whether it's books. Royalties are a form of payment for any type of intellectual property, and specifically informational materials such as commercial motion pictures. To have a regulation on the method of payment for those types of intellectual property and informational materials would be a violation of the First Amendment, because it would be a direct regulation of the importation and exportation of informational materials. Now, the Supreme Court cases have held the fact that motion pictures are commercial endeavors does not alter their protected status. This is Joseph Burstein, Inc. versus Wilson, Supreme Court decision. In Buckley v. Vallejo, the Supreme Court stated that...
Do you need to get to the constitutional argument?
Your Honor, the defendants keep moving...
No, I'm asking you a yes or no question. Do you need to have us get all the way to a constitutional argument to win your case?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the...
You don't think the statute and the regulations are enough?
Well, the statute is enough, because in it, it is incorporated the fact that the reason for excluding from the presidential powers the right to restrict or ban informational materials was because of a First Amendment issue. And so when the defendants claim that commercialization is not allowed and you can't send money back to Iran, commercialization, as I just mentioned, has found by the Supreme Court that commercialization, even the motion pictures, are require commercialization. That is a First Amendment that is clearly within the First Amendment rights, and that's an activity that can be done. As the defendants also admitted, the fact that you advertise is commercial speech, and that is protected by the First Amendment. Every activity that Mr. Kalantari has done in this case is protected by the First Amendment. Therefore, we don't even need to consider the regulations of 31 CFR 560. We don't even get to a balancing test. The Congress has already done the balancing test. Congress House report says commercial informational materials were exempted from the general prohibitions of the regulations to ensure that the embargo did not ban or restrict the import or export of information protected under the First Amendment. The only other issue here is the government, through its wisdom, because it wanted to create a bilateral relationship with Iran, so that not just Iranian entities have the right to register and enforce their copyrights in the United States, but U.S. entities will have the right to register their copyrights in Iran and to enforce their rights in the United States. As we indicated from the Senate report on the Berne Convention, the U.S. is the largest exporter of informational materials for which there's a huge surplus. We will be shooting ourselves in the head. It is not just the First Amendment issue, but it is also a commercial issue where the U.S. exporters of information and informational materials will be hurt. Any restriction that the court applies to the importation will necessarily apply to exportation. In this case, I think it would be harmful to every entity except for, I guess, the defendants. One other point I'd like to make, Your Honor. There are other well-recognized entertainment companies such as Sony Pictures, Miramax, etc. These are all importing informational materials, motion pictures from Iran. They are commercializing them. They are advertising them. They're promoting them. And if their copyright registrations are invalidated, then it would be open season for their motion pictures and everybody's business with regard to pirates such as NIT.
Thank you very much. That's the argument made in the briefs. I understand it. Thank you, counsel, for your argument. The matter just argued will be submitted. We'll turn to the last matter on the argument calendar, Tadema v. Streamworks.
For Plaintiff Mr. Idema. Thank you for the opportunity to address the Court today and hopefully to elucidate some of these issues that appear to be in need of clarity or resolution of conflict. I'm also honored to be joined in this inquiry with the veritable Dean of the Copyright Bar.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to briefly set a little bit of context for where we are at. We are trying to apply the rules set forth in Apple Computer and in Three Boys Music on substantial similarity and inverse ratio rule, and also taking a searching inquiry towards some of the plain meaning of the statute regarding derivative works. In a context, and pardon me, Your Honor, if I cite to a case that is not mentioned in the briefs, but the recent Supreme Court case of Eldred, in which affirmed the extension of the copyright amendments for the elongation of the limited term of protection for authors. And in it, the court reaffirmed the strong philosophy of protection in an age, in a post-industrial age, in which America is in large part a supplier of software, of entertainment, of artistic goods around the world. And I think that is important to put that in context. And a little bit of irony here as well, that the opponent in this case, DreamWorks, was then founded on the proposition of being writer-friendly and based on the idea that high concepts have considerable value in the entertainment world. And I think that one of the issues we can address, we can look directly to what DreamWorks says in its film. And it says, based on a story by Leslie Cockburn and Andrew Cockburn, it also says at the end of the credits that there is no allusion or reference to any historical figure in terms of character or event. This is not a nonfiction story. Now, I'd like to address first, Your Honor, the issue of preemption of the implied fact contract issue, because I think that this is the first case for the Ninth Circuit to squarely address this issue. We think that the evidence for what the Congress intended does not support what DreamWorks is saying. Disney versus Wilder was a very strong part of the entertainment law aspect of this country, borrowed in other states, and certainly a strong point of view for a half a century in the state of California, leading up from the capital. There's nothing in legislative history that indicated that Disney versus Wilder was intended to be overruled. And indeed, we have a situation, a case, the Scrabble case, in which you have the situation in which there's not enough copying or protectable expression to constitute copyright infringement, but yet the court did find that there is a breach of implied contract within that framework. And I think that that is one issue that the circuit should follow the lead of the other circuits and finding that in the Wrench case, for example, that we do not have any sort of preemption with respect to an exclusive remedy because you have an extra element. You have a contractual relationship, the kind of relationship that was identified in the by Justice Traynor in the Columbia case and also reiterated in the Gesner versus Wilder case.
Excuse me, go ahead.
I was going to ask you a question about the letter that was not accepted by the district court because the district court denied the motion to amend. Let's say this case ended tomorrow. Would the statute of limitations have run for you to file a fresh action based on that letter?
I would say not, Your Honor. I think that it would be part of the nucleus of facts that pertain to the original filed action. I don't believe we should have to file a new action.
That's not my question. My question is, if you had to, would the time have run?
No, Your Honor. In terms of the...
So I would ask, I suppose, your opponents to address the question why they're fighting so hard, because if you can... You can raise it here or you could raise it separately. I guess I don't see what the gain is on their part then.
Well, with respect to the letter as a copyright issue, I don't understand either, Your Honor, because as a matter of res judicata, it cannot be applied because their whole theory is that if it's not properly before the district court, the registration certificate for that letter, then by definition it's not a claim which could have been brought at that time. Therefore, it's not res judicata. Are not precluded from filing another action.
And whether they're right or wrong, as a matter of judicial estoppel, they wouldn't be able to raise res judicata in a second action based on a letter.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, but it does get us involved a little bit in the merits of that in terms of procedurally how should we go about doing it. And one way we can address it is by whether the denial for the request for leave to amend was an abuse of discretion. And I think under these circumstances, where there's been no prejudice because there is no discovery that was done. And therefore, the most important issue, I think, is their argument that it was futile to address the letter. And I don't see, in light of the chart.
Well, with respect to the items that are in the record, excluding the letter. What, in your view, are the most important elements that create a factual issue for a jury with respect to substantial similarity? We know it can't just be general plot ideas. We know it can't just be general character ideas. What are the specific developed elements, fictional elements, that you think would allow a finding of substantial similarity?
Well, first of all, the basic plot premise of smuggling a nuclear backpack weapon in a diplomatic pouch through to New York to go to the UN to atone in a distorted terrorist mind.
Now, was the UN in, I forget now if it was in the
novel.
It was
in Mr. Morris's treatment.
Okay, it was in the treatment. Okay. Go ahead.
And with respect to that, then there are various characters which are referenced in Red Bull Rising. The colonel, the friendly colonel, the dynamic between the lead character, the irreverent, brash, green beret, and as well as the daughter of the colonel, which was referenced and also in the movie in the hearing with respect to sending the Jeep, the vehicle over. There are a number of elements. And we can trace them by the chart by referencing the page references in the excerpts of record, which do not correspond to the letter citations, and they are numerous. What you don't have, and their point, as I take it, that you don't have it in a linear sequence placed as well as in the letter.
I think their position also is that the elements, at least taken singly, are generic, that you can't copyright a rash green beret, for example. That other people can have that character without filing a copyright.
Well, here's the error in their filtration analysis. And this relates, I think, also to an observation made in the Apple computer case. When you talk about sens affair, you have to have an evidentiary basis for it. You have to have something in the record, we believe, that says this is the prior art, so to speak, to use an analogy from the patent law field. This is the prior novel. This is the prior treatment. This is Rambo or it's not Rambo. And give the opportunity to the plaintiffs to draw a distinction. The plaintiffs did have expert testimony regarding whether there was an adequate precedent in the literature of novels and literature of films. They had Mr. Moore. They had a film critic. And they went through this. The other side presented nothing. So there's no opportunity to cross-examine that. An Apple computer, what Microsoft did is they had a video describing what the competitors did out there in the terms of sequencing their windows and tiling their windows. There's evidence in the record in Apple computer.
Well, that went to a slightly different point in Apple computer. I mean, the thing here is if you start with a generic idea or you start with some historical facts and you put a little gloss on them, is the gloss something that just naturally follows from the idea such that it's not protectable?
Okay. And then there would have to be something to inform that judgment, Your Honor.
Well, yes, by reading all of the submissions, by looking at the allegedly infringing work, by looking at the identified list of similarities, extracting from it what's protectable, filtering out what's unprotectable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And seeing what's left. And when you do all that, as the district court did, a fairly painstaking way, one is left with the abiding conclusion that the works are just totally dissimilar.
Well, Your Honor, we have to interpret the meaning of the statute based upon. That's the litmus test for determining whether a work is a derivative work. Whether they have permission.
Well, now, the derivative work thing comes up in the reply brief for the first time. So it seems to me what we're looking at is just in an ordinary copyright infringement sense, whether the eight submissions, excluding the 1994 letter, are substantially similar to Peacemaker in protectable elements.
All right. What I would address on that aspect, Your Honor, is that in order to determine, as the district court mainly relied upon two principles, and they were affirmative defenses, they were historical fact, merger, and sens affair.
Mm-hmm.
They had the duty to present evidence in support of that affirmative defense. They didn't provide any evidence.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pacelli, since I'm the culprit, obviously, I don't understand exactly what they failed to do that Apple says that they should have done.
Well, the sens affair, as we mentioned, Apple Computer said that there is reference sometimes needs for expert testimony.
Yeah.
They made a reference to the video played by Microsoft there to help explain sens affair. The Jackson case referred to.
But you have everything here in front of you. I mean, you don't have a licensing issue here like you had in Microsoft about the derivation of the graphical user interface. I mean, I don't understand what more the defendants would have done other than put on Peacemaker and say, okay, look at it and read the submissions and look at your comparison tape, all of which I've done, all of which we've all done. And so what I'm looking to you to do is to explain where it is specifically that there are protectable elements
that create a triable issue of substantial similarity?
Your Honor, with respect to, let's just take, for example, the first aspect, which is the retribution for an attack by UN or NATO and against the Muslim, and the retribution in terms of smuggling a nuclear backpack weapon obtained from a crumbling Soviet Union empire, and to bomb the UN, and to be saved through the efforts of a rogue character, Green Beret. You go through the list of all those items, and there's nothing in the literature that they evidenced in the record below which said any of those plot sequence points were manifest anyplace else. And here's where the problem we have in not having discovery go forward on this issue to basically test Sen's affair. We know from what's in the record that the film itself says that it was based upon an article by the Cockburns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the statutory language you're focusing on, derivative works, and the infringement of derivative work is based upon. We have, in essence, an admission that the DreamWorks knows how to calibrate what is based upon for giving credit. Now, if we examine what the district court summarized that article, an article that appeared well after the fact, you know that that could not possibly have been the source of it. There was a page and a half treatment which the district court summarized, which did come 3 months after the Idema Spielberg letter. And if you look at those elements, they are just a portion of the elements that are on the chart. But yet it was sufficient enough for them to put a credit on the film to say it was based upon. And I think this is an area in which, Your Honor, actions speak louder than words, so to speak. If, for example, one-fifth or one-sixth of the story propounded by the plaintiffs, which was in the page-and-a-half Cockburn treatment, was enough to instigate the movie and lead to credit of based upon, a fortiori, something five times more than that is enough to constitute infringement of the right to make derivative work. Now, the issue is, someone may say there's a lot of differences. Well, then we look to that in the allocation of damages. That's how we handle that issue. And the importance of that outline of the basic sequence of events is extremely important. There was the Frank Music case on the Kismet review done in Las Vegas, and there the court at the appellate level reversed the finding of 25% attributable to the basic concept sequence of events and said it should be 75%. In the a case which I regret we didn't cite, but the Rear Window case, Abend, which Mr. Petrich is very familiar with, there they said there was 20% perhaps of the basic sequence that was used in the movie, and that was enough. And this is what I think we were precluded from showing in discovery, is to say how that process came about, that they evaluated in their expertise, as their own experts, they came up with the point of what was based upon. And if you look at the page and a half summary by the district court of that treatment by the Cockburns, you don't even have the DeVoe character in there. You don't even have them going to the UN. You don't have them going to New York. All you have is the basic idea that smuggling weapons out of the Soviet Union, falling in the hands of terrorists in Eastern Europe, used to create a lot of problems. And if we would have had a discovery, and I would proffer this, Your Honor, in good faith, it's not in the record, but if there had been discovery, perhaps, I'll say hypothetically, maybe there might be disclosure that that page and a half treatment led within 2 hours of it being faxed to the acceptance of that, to the Cockburns being co-producers. And maybe we would have found out that Mr. Spielberg, hypothetically, was the source of the DeVoe character. I mean, this is a very unusual case. This is a case in which it's not about access. It's not about the opportunity to review. It's not even about reading it, which is what the Bochco case was about, and they considered that was access. This is where there was an admission that they had it, and they actually used it. And to me, this is extremely important. in terms of the derivation issue. And I want to save a little bit of my time on that because I think that there's an issue they raised on Arnstein versus Porter, which I think relevant to this case.
Okay. Well, then why don't we hear from Mr. Petridge, then we'll get back to you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am Louis Petridge, appearing for the DreamWorks defendants. I intend to show four things, that the plaintiffs attempt to amend their complaint on appeal to state a claim for copyright infringement based on a 1994 letter comes too late. But even if it were allowed, the judgment would still have to be affirmed. Second, that as a matter of law, the movie The Peacemaker is not substantially similar to any protected expression in any of the eight registered works, or as I said, even in the letter. Third, that the concession of access for purpose of getting a ruling where the works themselves are just compared with one another has no bearing on whether the works are substantially similar in their protected expression. Fourth, I think Mr. Pizzulli tried to raise the notion that somehow the test for showing that the Section 106(2) right to make a derivative work should have a different standard than substantial similarity he talks about based upon. And let me take that one first because that's...
I'm sorry. I have a question about number two, which seems to me to be the pivot of the case as it's come forward to us up until today, this question of substantial similarity. And even filtering out the unprotectable elements, because of the procedural posture of this case, we still have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the opposing party, to you. And with that standard in mind, I don't understand how we get away without a jury in this case, why there isn't a jury question about similarity in view of the concession of access.
Your Honor, there have been probably six or eight cases affirmed in this court where access was assumed, and I've been in several of them. Certainly the Litchfield versus Spielberg involving the motion picture. Berkey versus Crichton involving the movie Coma. A case decided...
Well, I understand your point. It can be done.
It can be done. And in fact, it was, Your Honor, excuse me, it was done in effect, it was done in two cases where access was found as a fact. In fact, copying was determined as a matter of fact. Judge Reimer in the Apple computer case, copying was not challenged. The question is whether what was copied was protected expression, and whether in all of these cases, especially where you have a claim not of piracy where you can show there was something taken in toto, word for word, but non-literal similarity, you always have to ask yourself, when we compare the level, compare the two works at the level of expression or at the level that the plaintiff claims there is a taking, are we talking about ideas? Are we talking about scenes of fare? Are we talking about general plot ideas?
In some respects, that would seem to be the case, but what about some of the details, like the can destroy 10 city blocks and other specific details that are fictional elements? They're very specific, and they appear to be in both works, or one of the works on one side and the Peacemaker on the
other. First of all, we're not told that they're fictional. We're told, and I think they come out of Jim Morris's treatment, and they come out of the Soldier of Fortune articles, and those statements are made as matters of fact. They're not made as matters of fictional items. The other problem is we have to also be careful that we aren't aggregating all eight works and comparing them to one, because what they're claiming is that at least at one level, they're claiming that they have a specific arrangement that gives them copyrightability of what otherwise are unprotectable matters. And what they're doing is cherry picking from the eight and say, well, look, 10 city blocks. The district judge pointed out in three other occasions they talked about other kinds of damage areas. They talked about 50 blocks. They talked about a third of a mile, I think it was. So there really isn't anything about to be made of that. And in any event, it's not expression. For someone, they aren't claiming the dialogue was taken. That's an idea, that a bomb can take out a number of blocks. And what is going on when we talk about things like that?
So it sounds like what you're saying is if they have a claim at all, it's a Destiny kind of claim.
That would probably be the best claim they would have, and I'll go to that. I don't think they have that claim either.
I have one sort of question for my own interest only, and that is whether the parties have engaged in any attempt to settle or mediate this dispute, either through our mediation services or otherwise.
We've talked to the mediator of the Ninth Circuit, and we've also, well, the parties haven't, but the attorneys haven't. We've made the same offer that was made by the other defendants who were recently dismissed, waiver of attorney's fees. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you look at them at the level at which the plaintiff claims there has been a taking, what you see is abstractions or ideas or scenes of fear. And I know counsel says that the judge should have had an evidentiary hearing on the scenes of fear issue. But let's look at what the scenes of fear were that she found. She found that in a case where you're talking about smuggling nuclear weapons out of a country, that it's a scene of fear that you'll come to a border or to a checkpoint, and that you might have a skirmish at the border or checkpoint. I think that's self-evident. I don't think you need to have an evidentiary hearing. She says that in a case where you are talking about a story, and after all, this is all fact-based, the notion that when the Soviet Union fell apart, there wasn't adequate security of these nuclear weapons, and there was a great concern that they would be smuggled out of the country. She says that it is a scene of fear that when you smuggle out of Russia, you'll probably run into Iraq or Iran because they're on the border. That was one of the scenes of fear. And, of course, the standard in this circuit for scene of fear is not that it has to happen every time, but simply that it is something that flows naturally from the plot premise. And we have a major concession here by the plaintiff's expert, Mr. Whitmore. He said that in a case where you have a premise that the works were, that both works are about a failed effort to take a nuclear weapon from Russia to the United States, that in his words, he says, from a story premise about a nuclear theft and almost successful terrorist act, quote, the sequence of events is dictated by this premise, end quote. We cite that in our answering brief at page 31, note 41. I think that's probably a little extreme, because I don't think every incident is dictated by it. But certainly the kind of incidents that you're going to have, they can be strung in different ways to tell a different story. And here the stories are quite different. Plaintiff's story, whether you go to the letter or whether you go to his eight works, are all about how he goes to Lithuania and takes up with this fellow who's the head of the police force, and they chase some smugglers around, and they find out there's nuclear smuggling going on. Then he comes back to the United States. That's not in our movie at all. And there he gets in trouble with the FBI. He says he was framed, and the FBI put him in prison. That's not in our movie. And then he's sprung in some versions of the story. He's sprung from prison, and he goes back to Lithuania. And there they chase the smugglers down to Iraq. In our movie, we go to Iran. We stop, the smugglers are stopped around Azerbaijan. And then he, in some versions of his story, they chase the terrorist, who's he's described as a world-class terrorist. Ours is a piano teacher who is also a member of the Bosnian parliament. And he smuggles nuclear weapons into the United States, and there's a big dispute about whether the nuclear weapons are even alike. They have so-called backpack weapons that are made for that purpose. In ours, it's a trigger for a nuclear weapon that is carried with a backpack. In theirs, the smuggler has great contact with the Middle East terrorists. He supposedly has dinner with all of the terrorists, and they're named Abu Nidal and Yasser Arafat, etc. And using PLO connections, he gets the missile into the backpack device into JFK. In ours, the man is a member of the UN delegation, and he gets it into the airport. In some versions of theirs, the story ends at the airport. There's a fight, and the Green Beret shoots the terrorist in the airport, contrary to instructions from the White House. In ours, the terrorist proceeds to Manhattan, and he's not shot. He shoots himself, but he's carrying this nuclear trigger, and it's disarmed by Julia Kelly. So what has happened is, in both works and all of the works, you have people using the general building blocks for a story about nuclear weapons and smuggling and terrorism and a threat at in the U.S. And I should point out, again, by aggregating their works, they've covered a lot of territory. They have potential use of this weapon at the World Trade Center. They talk about blowing up bus stations. They talk about other places in Manhattan. And they talk about the UN. So they've kind of covered the major points in the major entry into the United States, New York. But ultimately what's protected is at least, I would say, three levels. You have the story level, where you're talking about the pattern of the characters, the character relationships, and the essential sequence of events. And this circuit has said many times that when you're looking at the sequence of events, you don't juxtapose them out of order, because it's the sequence that is the arrangement that is protectable. And that's what you compare. And they could also, I suppose, try to look at specific scenes, like the scene of the confrontation of the smugglers at a checkpoint or a border. But they're quite different. You have to look at the details, because it's the details, not the idea, that's protected. In this case, depending on which of the eight versions you take, they have a confrontation at the border leaving Lithuania. They go west, by the way. We go south. In Lithuania, they have this confrontation at the border, where they send two cars ahead. They have two trucks, and they have people, in one version anyway, it takes 50 pages in Red Bull Rising. And they have people in the woods waiting, and then they have a shootout, and they go in, they kill all the guards, and then they go into the barracks and kill everybody in the barracks. In ours, the bad guy, Kordoff, I guess it's Kordoff, has one truck disguised as a Red Cross truck. He's stopped. The guard becomes suspicious, and he shoots the guard. And then they shoot the other couple of guards that are standing around. They're all done completely different. And as Judge Collins said, it's not very surprising that if you're smuggling weapons out of a country, you're going to cross a border or a checkpoint, and you're probably going to have a confrontation, if it's going to be a drama. If you don't have a confrontation, maybe it's a different kind of story. As far as the characters go, the rule in this circuit is quite clear. It's very difficult to claim protection for word picture characters that are described. The most likely situation where characters are protected are either where the character tells the story itself. In a sense, Mr. Idema might be that, if what you're focusing on is his problems with the U.S. government and his that kind of thing. Maybe that's the story. But that's not our story. In practice, the only time characters are protected in and of themselves usually is where they have some particular unusual physical presence or garb. They started out, they protected comic book characters, Superman, because he had a cape, and Wonder Woman, and so on. Over time, there have been some who have very distinctive things about them, such as James Bond, because we have a series of works, and if you copy all the accoutrements around him, maybe he's protected. But we don't have anyone like that. Now, as far as the concession of access for sake of argument, as I said earlier, we've got the Litchfield case, the Burkitt case, Cavalier just last year, Koof, another movie case, Norell case, involving the use of historical work to write a fictional work. All of them assumed, for sake of argument, that there was access. All of them, the court was able to determine whether or not there was any taking of protectable expression. We have several cases where copying is established. Feist in the U.S. Supreme Court, the telephone directory case. Everybody agreed they copied. They copied it verbatim. So if they had infinite access, why did they have to put on any showing of substantial similarity of protected expression? Because the U.S. Constitution and free speech requirements mean that copyright the accommodation between copyright and free expression is inherent in the idea of expression by copying. And for that reason, this circuit in Croft and the U.S. Supreme Court in Harper and Row said, you have to make sure, de novo, whether or not we are properly enforcing that line between idea and expression. It can't be done casually. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you close, I want to take you back to the problem of the letter as to whether the district court abused its discretion in not allowing an amendment. As I understand it, Adema was still acting pro se at that time.
He was, Your Honor, but he was acting in concert with co-owners. He had argued that that letter was owned jointly by him and the three other plaintiffs who all had counsel. All their papers were filed as a joint filing. Counsel filed the papers, and Mr. Adema also filed them.
If we were to find that we should be more tolerant because Adema was acting pro se and were to send it back to admit the letter, we might be into a situation where the case would have to go forward with discovery and go forward with a trial. It seems to me that there's a bit of need possibly to reconsider mediation and settlement in this case.
Well, we're not opposed to it. It just hasn't happened, Your Honor. But one of the things that I think has to be noted is that this case had a history. Mr. Adema and the other parties were given a year's notice that they had to register whatever they sued on. It's a jurisdictional requirement. Subject matter jurisdiction can't be obtained in a copyright case by a party unless there's registration. It was never pled as a copyright case. They always pled the letter in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth causes for as an idea submission case. They did it tactically. We pointed out that on our motions that led up to the summary judgment and the motion to dismiss, they argued to the court that there could be no preemption of their idea submission case under the letter because it was not copyrightable. There's a judicial estoppel there. At least some point, the district judge should be able to rely on what's submitted to the district court.
There's also, counsel, I guess, the issues of whether the state court actions should have been dismissed, there may still be an issue of a breach of confidentiality as to the letter, question of contract that may not be preempted. There are a lot of kind of messy issues floating around here.
Well, I think if you look at the contract case, one thing that stands out is it's only against three parties, and one of them has recently been dismissed, Mr. Peterson. So that leaves you DreamWorks. And there is no allegation that they had a contract with DreamWorks. The letter was sent to to Amblin, which is not a party, and addressed to Mr. Spielberg, who is a party. But there's no allegation that they did satisfy the preconditions for creating a contract with Mr. Spielberg, because there was no chance for him to say, I don't want your letter. They just sent it to him, and they tried to impose liability by putting the word confidential on the letter. I think my time is up. I'm sorry I didn't get to the preemption issue. If you have any questions about it, I would be glad to do
it. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Priscilli?
None of those cases that were cited by counsel, there's evidence or admission of actual copying, which is what we have here. The use of materials sent to Mr. Schiffer, the party admission obtained from him, party admission obtained from Mr. Peterson. And let's also talk about, briefly, the filtration analysis. At any level of abstraction, if you consider going up high and high enough to the level of abstraction, everything or nothing, I should say, is original. It all goes back to Genesis. That's not what we do in these kind of cases. We use a sense of judgment. Let's look at the counterfactual in this case. Let's look at what they described their film to be. And then, as we did in our reply brief, we X'd out elements that came from IDEMA. And what did they have left? They did not have enough to constitute the first film for DreamWorks, a message film sent by Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Katzenberg, the author of the famous memo about high concept films. This was a high concept film. You have to take it in context. We didn't have the right to do discovery. We would have shown, we believe, Your Honor, the nexus between Mr. Spielberg and his use of the DeVoe IDEMA character that in connection with this film. But we were not allowed to do that. Now, what's interesting, in their brief, they talk about adopting the Arnstein versus Porter, the Second Circuit case. And it's very interesting, and I would commend court's attention to this. I did not do that in the reply brief, and I apologize for that. But if we look at the Croft case goes into Arnstein versus Porter and purports to follow it. And what's interesting is what they said, that once you get to a finding of actual copying, the issue of whether there has been unlawful appropriation, which is where they say the juncture we're at in terms of evaluating the effect of Sons of Fair, is the proper criterion on that issue is not analysis or other comparison of respective compositions. They go on to say it's not an extrinsic dissection test issue. We are at the stage with the admissions that we have in this case of getting to the intrinsic level. And I think that's what Your Honor indicated is the question is, why isn't this before the jury? We have gotten to that issue with their admissions. They were unrebutted. Unrebutted. This is not a situation. They were not pro se. They had all the access to the best experts in the world, and they couldn't come up with one iota of evidence, not one, that said this was a prior art. This IDEMA story was not novel, and they can't, because when you do the reverse filtration and you strip away the IDEMA story elements from their story as they characterize it, they have nothing but a shell left. And let's take that just one step further, and I appreciate it. If I could have another minute, Your Honor.
Just wrap it up if you can.
Let's assume the Peacemaker came first. And then there was a film based on the IDEMA letter, the IDEMA elements. Are they really going to say with a straight face that they had no claim for an infringement of the second work? And that's really the logical extension here. And that I think puts the objective test at issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, thank you for your argument. The matter just argued will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess for the day.
This court for the session stands adjourned.